All right, I hope that you slept well last night. I know some of the guys decided to get up and serve everyone else and do a little homemaking this morning. And thankful for them. I hope that you're able to stay awake in our session here this morning. As we continue to consider, why Christianity, what's the beauty of the gospel. As I mentioned last night, what I'd like to do this morning and then this afternoon is to consider some ideas that are put in opposition to Christianity and to kind of evaluate them. And the first one I want to consider together is one that's becoming increasingly visible in our day. And it's the worldview of atheism. There have been atheists around for a long time. In the last probably 30 years, there's been a sharp increase. It began a little bit earlier than that as far as a little bit more outspoken. But in the last 30 years, there's been the rise of what's called new atheism. You've heard of people like Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion, or the late Christopher Hitchens, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And even in titles like that, you realize that they don't have a lot of favorable views of God and Christianity. You know, it's a delusion. It poisons everything. God's not great. And so I want to take some time this morning to think through that issue and to consider the issue of atheism. And I want to begin by first considering, what if it's true? What if atheism is true? What if God does not exist? And there'd be a lot of ramifications of that. I want to begin by just considering two, and then we'll actually touch on some others as we go along. But the first thing that would be true, that if God doesn't exist, then there's no ultimate meaning in the world. There may be what we call relative meaning, you know, between people, but in the big scheme of things, your life has no meaning. The world has no meaning. This is what Richard Dawkins has to say. There is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It's every living object's sole reason for being. And if you ask, well, why should we propagate DNA? There's no reason. Because there's no meaning. Because in order to have meaning, you have to have some kind of overarching reality. You have to have, as well, the potential for immortality. But without God, there isn't that. Some of you maybe have read H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. In that book, you have a man who goes far into the future and basically sees where the world ends. And he gets out and it's just this nothingness. And so then he goes back in time and begins to live in, you know, where he was, but that reality haunts him. Because if that's where the world's going, then why does it matter what I'm doing right now? What's the meaning of life? The answer is there is no meaning. And philosophers have struggled with this. One of the philosophers that is probably most well known for this kind of idea is Jean-Paul Sartre. He said there is no meaning in life. So what do we do? Well, we choose our own meaning. And then we live out that meaning. But the problem with that is that's just self-delusion. That's just lying to yourself and saying your life has meaning when it doesn't. And trying to fool yourself into thinking that way. Because if there's no God, there's no meaning. Secondly, if there's no God, there's no purpose. Because purpose implies intention. If there's a purpose for something, it implies someone designed it for that purpose or intended it for that purpose. But if there's no God, then everything in the universe is the result of what we could call a series of accidents or chance. That things just happen to happen this way. And so in Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, he points out, it looks like there's design in the world. But really, there's no design in the world. It's just because of the way natural selection works, certain things look like they were made for this world, made for this life, but they aren't really. It's just, this is happened to be the world that formed. And so if you ask the big question that people ask, why am I here? The answer is, there's no reason. There's no reason for why you're here. And so some philosophers, again, have tried to push back against the darkness of that reality. Because if you have no meaning and no purpose, then life is kind of depressing. And there's no reason not to just kind of live in anarchy. And so there are people who have put forward what they call the noble lie. And the noble lie is to be able to convince yourself that there is meaning and purpose so that we can work together as a society. But even that very title kind of undermines it, right? I mean, a noble lie. So you need to trick yourself. You need to fool yourself into thinking something that's good when really there is no meaning and purpose. And in light of these realities, since there's no meaning and purpose, it also means there's really no beauty. Because we might think something's beautiful. Like we look out here over this lake and we see the leaves. And you look at that and you're like, man, that's beautiful. But it's not really beautiful. All it is there's the way that we were developed over time. There's neurochemical, biological processes that when you see something like this, you respond favorably. Because our ancestors recognized, not that they recognized, happened to develop, so it's helpful for us to survive, that areas like this were helpful for finding food and survival. And so we see them, and we think, oh, that's beautiful, but it's not really beautiful, because there is no beauty. And there's also no love, because if there's no meaning and purpose, you can't really have love. All you have is actually, you see someone and you have biological reaction that says this person would be good for mating. Because we're designed to propagate DNA. But there's no love, there's no beauty, if there's no God. And we think about a world like this, and we don't really want to live in a world like this. And if you talk to most people, they don't think our world is really like this. Even most atheists don't live as if there's no meaning and purpose in the world. And actually, that's some of you have probably heard of Nietzsche. He was a philosopher in the 1800s. And he's often quoted as saying, God is dead. But what you may not know is when he's talking about that, in part what he's saying is this. All you philosophers out there, you all think that God does not really exist. You don't think the Bible's true, but you still act as if it is. And so he has this parable of the madman, which is one of his significant writings that people point to. And the madman is basically a representation of Nietzsche. And he comes out and he's going around saying, I seek God. He's got this lantern, it's kind of night. I seek God, I seek God. And everyone in town's kind of, who's this crazy guy, you know? But where did you lose God? Is he hiding somewhere? And they're kind of mocking him. And then this bad man turns. And he just pierces the townspeople with his eyes. And he says this, whither is God? I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? And what he's saying is, you don't understand what we've done. This is a massive thing that we've done. How can you drink up the sea? And we're saying there is no God. That has massive ramifications. Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? There's no foundation now. Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward in all directions? Is there any up or down left? There's no starting point. There's no foundation. Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night and more night coming on all the while? Must not lanterns be lit in the morning? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? God is dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? And then it says he looked around and he realized everyone just kind of shocked and taken back. And so he says, he smashes his lantern against her hand, says, I've come too early. This tremendous event is still on its way. It's not yet reached the ears of man. And part of his point there is, you don't realize the implications of your belief that there is no God. Now, Nietzsche still believes there is no God. And he said, I want to carry out those implications. And he developed the philosophy which is referred to as nihilism, which is basically nothing matters. And so what he said is, we need to become our own supermen, and we need to impose our will upon reality. And one of the things that ended up coming out of his philosophy was Nazis. And this is the reality that we face, that there's no God. But as I said, most people aren't like Nietzsche. Most people don't really live that way. And I want to suggest this morning that the reason people don't live that way is that they know there is a God. And I want you to look at Romans 1 with me. Romans chapter 1. People don't act as if the world is meaningless and the world is purposeless because they know better. And they know better because they know that there is a God. Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now, Paul is pointing out people know God, that they recognize God in creation, that they understand who he is because it's part of who we are as people made in his image. And one of the reasons we know that, and I want to pull out three things from this passage, is that we believe certain things are true that can't be true if God doesn't exist. And the first is that we believe we can know things. We believe we have knowledge. And yet, without God, we can't have knowledge. And I think this is perhaps hinted at in verse 21. They became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. This is in part, you maybe have heard the verse twice it happens in the Psalms, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. You think that's kind of harsh. You know, you're saying only dumb people. Well, not dumb people. People who don't believe in God can't understand the world properly. And here's what I'd like to explain about why that's true. Because in order for us to know something, two things have to be true. We have to know that our cognitive faculties, our ability to think and reason, are working properly, and that they are intended to reach truth. And if those two things are true, then we can trust our thinking and know that we know things. But I want to consider two alternatives to the idea of the belief in God that end up undermining thinking. And the first is skepticism. How many of you ever heard of David Hume? A couple of you. He's very well known, wrote in the late 1700s. He wrote an article about against miracles, and he really pushed forward what's called empiricism, the idea that you can only know things through your experiences and your senses. But as he began to work through this further, he began to basically recognize that really, why would we even trust that our senses are giving us the right information? What gives us that foundation? We just assume they do. And that's how we know that the world, that's why we think we know things. But really, how do we know that our senses are really there? And so he said, well, if I'm going to doubt things, then I really got to doubt all the way. And so basically, he gets to the point where more or less he has to recognize he can't really know anything, including the fact that he doesn't know that he can know anything. And here's an illustration. This is taken from Alvin Plantinga. He's had a philosophy at Notre Dame for years. He's written a ton of stuff. And he illustrates it this way. Let's say you go out to this distant planet. You know, you're one of these people who's doing space exploration. And you come on this planet and you get out, and there's a radio there. And it's talking in English. You're like, this is incredible. And it's saying things like, the weather in Beijing at this moment is 67 degrees Fahrenheit. And the morning that Caesar crossed the Rubicon, he had eggs on toast for breakfast. And the first human being to cross the Bering Strait and set foot in North America was left-handed. And you're hearing these things, you're like, man, this is incredible. How does this machine know these things? And your first inclination is to be like, that's amazing that they would be able to give this information. But then you stop and consider, well, wait a minute. I don't know that any of those things are true. I don't know where this machine came from. So how do I know that it's designed to give accurate information? Maybe it's actually designed to give false information. And I have no way of verifying it. And so if you're going to be rational, at that point in time, what you have to do is you have to say, I don't know whether or not what these things are saying is true, because I don't know where this thing came from. And Plantinga says that's basically what Hume recognized with our minds. Our minds are telling us things we think are true. Like, I think I look at this whiteboard here. I think it looks white with some kind of blue and red kind of faded on there. But how do I know that's true? Maybe I'm being deceived. Maybe actually my mind's just in a vat somewhere and some mad scientist is like poking me and prodding me and making me think that all of you are real. Or actually maybe I'm an illusion. How do you know? On what basis do you have to trust these things? And so Hume rightly drew the conclusion, I can't know anything. Because I don't know where I came from. Because if you ask him, where did the universe come from? He said, well, there's multiple options. Maybe God made the world. I don't know. Maybe some alien made the world. I don't know. And since I don't know, I can't know anything. The second major worldview that really ends up undermining knowledge is naturalism. And naturalism says, I know where the world came from. The world is the result of evolutionary processes. So everything that develops is the result of mutations and natural selection that over time brought us to where we are. That's how we got here. So now you know, this is how we got here. But how does that process work? Well, if that's all true, you know what also got here as the result of mutation and natural selection is our cognitive function, the way we think, the way we reason. Well, how does mutation and natural selection work? That they are designed, as Dawkins pointed out earlier, to propagate DNA for survival. And so they develop so that we respond properly to our environment and have a better chance of living within our environment. So in naturalism, what are beliefs? Well, beliefs are natural things. They're neural events. They have electrochemical properties. And so we think certain ways, and that causes our body to respond in certain ways, so then we react in certain ways. And typically when we think of beliefs, we're thinking about content. We're thinking about, I believe that this whiteboard is white with red and blue on it. But I can have the exact same chemical reaction if I believe that this whiteboard is green with blue and yellow on it. But the content of my belief is separate from the actual chemical reactions that are happening to me. And furthermore, it might actually theoretically be more beneficial for me to believe something that's false, because that causes me then to behave in a way that helps me to survive better. So in naturalism, what ends up happening is we again have no reason to trust that our thinking is working properly, because our minds aren't directed towards truth. They're directed towards survival. And so therefore, we can't trust our thinking. And so we can't really know anything. Ironically enough, we can't even know that naturalism is true. Because if naturalism is true, then the only reason we believe naturalism is true is because that helps us to survive. But that doesn't mean that we actually know it's true. And I think that's the kind of thing that Paul's pointing out, that our thinking becomes futile, because if we really believe what we claim we believe, then we can't believe anything. And yet, we think we know things. Probably none of you were like, you know what, Ben, you might be an illusion. Right? You're like, no, you're not an illusion. None of you were like, if I said, you know what's actually true? None of us have existed for more than 10 minutes. Be like, no, I remember like eating breakfast like 30 minutes ago. And none of you doubt that. Because we know there's a God. And because there's a God, we actually know that there is a God who is a rational God who made us to know Him. And so He designed our thinking to be geared towards truth. Now, what ends up happening is we end up suppressing the truth very often. We don't always get to truth. And that's where our minds end up swerving off, but not because of the design. Actually, because of what we talked about yesterday with sin. So we know our minds are geared to work properly, so that's why we are able to function and to work and to think. Because we actually know there is a God. Second thing that we know. But before we move on, let me just touch on this too. David Hume, I mentioned him already, in relating to this idea of thinking, he really questioned something that we tend not to question, but we probably should. So science, right? The way science works is if I do the same experiment 99 times, what I'm supposed to be able to do then is to say, if I did it 100th time, what's going to happen? Same result. And Hume said, well, how do we know that? And we said, well, we've done it 99 times. He says, but that doesn't tell us the future. That what you're saying is, well, I did it 99 times, and so I'm going to guess it's going to happen again the 100th time. He says, well, how do you know that? What could have done 99 times? No. That you're begging the question, right? You're assuming the regularity of nature to prove the regularity of nature. And so that's one of the reasons why he said, nature makes us think we know things, but when we actually have to force ourselves, we don't really know them. If you ask me, how do you know it's going to happen 100th time? The answer ultimately is, well, God designed the world to function according to the laws of nature. That's how I know it happens this way. Which is actually why modern science grew up in a society that was shaped by Christian thinking and not by Hindu thinking or Buddhist thinking. Because in Christian thinking, we actually have the foundation for science. We have the laws of nature that are in place because God has designed those things to be in place. And so even the fact that we trust science really only works if God is there. Let me move on briefly then to morality. I laid out the moral argument for God. And I want to tease out the first two aspects of it, actually in reverse order. the moral argument goes like this. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But objective moral and values and duties do exist, therefore God exists. What do I mean by objective moral values and duties? Well, objective is in opposition to subjective. So I'm a subject, and this chair would be an object, or this feeling would be an object. And objective is pointing out that morality exists outside of us. That morality is not based upon what I think, or what all of us think, or how our culture functions. That morality is outside of us. And the values and duties, one way to think of it is values are basically something that's right or wrong, where duties are things that you should or should not do. Because some things may be right, but you don't have to do them. But some things are right and you have to do them. So with duties, we get into not just things are good, but there's an oughtness. That we are obligated to do things that are good and not do things that are evil. So, first of all, let's consider, do objective moral values and duties exist? And you might be someone, and maybe you've talked to someone who says, no, they don't. That our morals are just kind of our society's values. That's all morals are. And so there's no kind of objective morality. It's just the way that we tend to think. But almost no one that I've talked to really believes that. Because we live in a world that is continually expressing moral outrage. Think a few years back, the Occupy Wall Street movement. So you had people out there, you know, gathering in cities all over the place. We had a group in Detroit. And they're saying things like, we need to change the world because it's wrong for the 1% to have all of these things. And if you ask them, but, I mean, that's not really true, right? I mean, that's just kind of your opinion. And say, no, but this is wrong, and we need to change it. Or even just this summer, I think it was Leo the lion. That might not have been his name. But some lion over in, like, Africa, Tanzania, or Zambia, and a dentist, it was either Minnesota or Wisconsin, right, shot this lion. And maybe you saw, I mean, you had, you know, newscast people, late show talk hosts, crying, upset over this reality. And if you ask them, but, I mean, it's not really wrong, right? That's just your opinion. It's like, no, that's not my opinion. It's wrong for us to do that. And let's get to some issues that maybe even more of us would very easily say, you know, that's just wrong. Rape. We talk about the fact that we have a rape culture. But you know what we're not saying? That means rape is good. We're saying we have a rape culture that we need to stop. And so if you talk to someone, I've done this, I've had conversations with people, and I'll say, so do you think there's anything in the world that's wrong, no matter what anyone thinks about it? And they're like, no, morals are just our opinions. So you're walking across and you see a guy raping a girl. Would you stop him? And they're like, yeah. Well, why? I mean, who are you to impose your moral opinions on this guy? But we don't say, well, that's his belief. We're like, I don't care what he thinks. It's wrong. You have someone who says, you know what? I think it's fine for me to abuse little boys. And we say, no, that is not okay. That's wrong. No matter what you think, it's wrong. Right. And if you think about it this way, that we believe in moral objective values and duties because we would say something, I hope, like, the Holocaust is wrong. It was wrong what happened. And it would still be wrong if Germany had won. And it was wrong in Nazi Germany, even though everyone there thought it was okay. Because it didn't matter what they thought. It's just wrong. Now, you might have someone who says, and occasionally you'll have someone who will say something like, well, no, for them it was okay. And usually, they say that because they realize if they don't say that, then they're not being consistent with what they've said. That morality is subjective. So, then I try to make it perhaps a bit more personal. And ask something like, so what if I took your wallet right now? Or what if I punched you in the face? Like, would that be okay? And typically what ends up happening is you find out, even if in theory we want to say morals are subjective, in reality we know better. And just for what it's worth, I find it interesting. In the studies that have been done, people who teach philosophy at universities almost all believe in objective moral values. The people who don't are the students at the universities. Because we've been trained with this idea of, well, there's nothing really right, there's nothing really wrong. But then we know better. Even in spite of our training, we still come out and get morally outraged at things that are happening, because we ultimately can't avoid the fact that there are objective moral values. But that then leads to the first premise. Where did they come from? If objective moral values and duties exist, where did they come from? That if they're cultural, then we shouldn't ever want to change a culture. And so if these objective moral values are not based on subjective things, but they're a cultural thing, then essentially what we're saying is whether or not you kill someone is basically kind of like whether or not you burp too loudly at the dinner table. Because it's just a cultural thing. And you don't want to push against the taboos of your society. And most of us are like, that doesn't seem quite like what I believe and what I'm saying. But there's something more to it than that. And without God, there is no explanation for objective morality. Because it can't be the result of naturalism. Because naturalism, remember what naturalism geared us toward? Naturalism geared us towards survival. And so if naturalism is why we say, well, we have morality because morality helps us to survive. But that's only true within our group. And so that would make sense for us to say, yes, it might be good for me to sacrifice for my son, because my son then can kind of has a better chance of actually carrying on DNA for my group, my DNA. But it doesn't make sense then for me to sacrifice for some stranger that I don't know. But you know what we tend to think? I can't believe someone would sacrifice for a stranger. That's a noble act. But that can't be explained by naturalism. Because naturalism has no explanation for why we would do things outside of our group. As well, as we look at nature, we recognize nature is violent. And yet, we don't tend to think that's how we should act. But, if naturalism is true, then why wouldn't we act that way? Darwin himself wrote in The Descent of Man, "If men were reared under precisely the same conditions as hive bees, there could hardly be a doubt that our unmarried females would, like the worker bees, think it a sacred duty to kill their brothers. And mothers would strive to kill their fertile daughters, and no one would think of interfering." But we don't think that way. And Darwin says, well, it's just because of how the human developed. I said, no, it's not just because of how humans developed. We know better. There's objective morality. Because only God has the authority to tell us what's right and what's wrong. Maybe you've done this before. I remember when I was growing up, if one of my brothers or a friend or something kind of started to get a little bossy, we might say something like, well, who died and made you God? And the point there is, you know who gets to tell everyone what to do? God does. And we recognize that. Because look back at Romans 1 in verse 20. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature. His divine nature is a translated in some ways his Godhead. I think it's his Godness. And part of what we know is that God is God. You know what that means? God gets to say what's right and what's wrong. We saw that in Genesis 1. I referred to that in Genesis 1 yesterday. He's the one who says, this is good, this is not good. And no one else has that authority. If I stand up and say, okay, everyone, this is how everyone needs to live, you'd be like, you're a little bit full of yourself, right? Because I don't have that kind of authority. But God does. That's what it means to be God. Now, let me briefly deal with the issue you might have, and then let me provide a disclaimer, all right? First, let me deal with the issue. You say, so does that mean that, like, we're just left at this, like, the mercy of this arbitrary God who just gets to decide, hey, this is now good or this is now bad? So God could say, now I want everyone to torture puppies. And it's like, well, we've got to do it because God told us to do that. I'd say in some religions that's true. Actually, in mainstream Sunni Islam, the answer would be, yeah, God could do that. But in Christianity, the answer is God would never do that. Because God in his very essence is good. That you don't have, like, well, here's God, and he just kind of says, okay, this is what's good. Nor do you have, well, here's God, and here's goodness that's kind of over him, and so God's bound by it. You actually have God is good. And so everything that he commands is good. He can't lie. Because it's against his very nature. He can't do wrong. Because he's God. He can only do right. And so we don't have to fear that God's commands are going to be wrong because of who he is. Now, my disclaimer. I say both this for knowledge and for morality. Because you might be thinking, so you're saying that, like, you're an idiot if you don't believe in God, and you're just going to, like, go out and start killing people if you don't believe in God? Because I know people who don't believe in God, and they're really smart, and they're really good people. I say, well, I'm not saying that you have to believe in God to be smart, or you have to believe in God to be good. What I'm saying is this. Without God, you have no basis for knowing anything, and you have no basis for explaining morality. Remember what I've already said? People believe in God. People know there's a God even if they don't believe in him. And so they act better than their beliefs. They may not have an explanation for how they know things, but they know a ton of stuff. They don't have an explanation for what's right or wrong, but they do good things. And Romans 2 actually points out part of why. Look over at Romans 2 and verse 14. For when Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses, the Old Testament written, given to people, by nature do what the law requires, they are law to themselves, even though they do not have the law, they show that the work of the law is written on their hearts. That God's moral law is written on people's hearts. Which is actually one of the reasons why people say, well, all around the world people kind of believe the same things are right and wrong. It's like, well, yeah, because God made us that way. That it's not like, I have no idea what to do. Oh, now the Bible, like, explains all of morality to me. The problem, though, is what he goes on to say. Their consciences bear witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. So what happens is, we don't always even do what we know is right. And then sometimes we end up convincing ourselves against what we actually know is better, that certain things are right when they're wrong. And so one of the things we need is we need God's written law to come along and help correct us. We don't need it to just help us understand morality at all. The third thing I want to look at, though, is the issue of justice. Look down at verse 32. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things, things like envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness, gossip, slanderers, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, they practice such things, deserve to die. They not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. I mentioned this yesterday. You know what everyone in the world thinks? There's something wrong with the world. And we think that people who do wrong should
be punished for it. We think that justice should happen. But you know what? If naturalism is true, how in the world did we get that belief? Because if naturalism is true, the world's exactly like it's supposed to be. And we were designed to live in this world. Which means we should think this is exactly the way the world's supposed to be. But we don't. And we don't because someone outside the world has put something in us. As Ecclesiastes says, God has put eternity in our hearts. That we know this is not the way things are supposed to be. But if God didn't exist, then it wouldn't be this way. And if God didn't exist, there would not be justice. I'm going to read a quotation from Richard Wurmbrand in Tortured for Christ. He was a Soviet pastor. And describing some of what he experienced under the Soviet Union. He says, "The cruelty of atheism is hard to believe when man has no faith in the reward of good or the punishment of evil. There's no reason to be human. There's no restraint from the depths of evil which is in man. The communist torturers often said, there is no God, no hereafter, no punishment for evil. We can do what we wish." I've heard one torturer even say, "I thank God in whom I don't believe that I have lived to this hour when I can express all the evil in my heart." He expressed it in unbelievable brutality and torture inflicted on prisoners. And if God does not exist, they got away with it. I read a massive biography of Chairman Mao this summer, and it was shocking to me how evil he was. I mean, things from the fact when he was younger, his mother got deathly sick, and he said, "I'm not going to go see her because I don't want my final image of her to be her in this sick state." And so my needs certainly come over the needs of my mother. And so he refused to see his dying mother. He ends up marrying a woman, abandoning her and a child, marrying another woman, abandoning her and some children. Once he gets into power, estimated 70 million people die in peacetime, many of them by starving, because he took as more food than was physically possible for him to take from the farmers so he could trade to be able to get weapons so he could increase his power. Not to mention the millions more who died through the wars that he got the people involved in. And when he comes to the end of his life, he actually, first of all, one of his closest associates, he refuses to allow him to receive treatment for cancer, so he will die before Mao dies. And then as Mao gets ready to die, he makes a deal with the people who he has a pretty good feel are probably going to come into power to say, "Will you wait until I die? And then you can have my wife and you can do whatever you want with her and punish her." And he dies in his room. Yeah, he had some physical suffering at the end. But certainly nothing that would compare to the amount of physical suffering it caused. We read something like that and we think, people shouldn't be able to get away with that. But if there's no God, then they do. And the good news is that there is a God. Look over at Romans 12. Romans 12 and verse 14. Sorry, I actually started, let's go down to verse 19. We'll read verse 14 first. "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them." Now go down to verse 19. "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God." Now we read things like that and we think,
And that sounds great. Bless those who persecute you. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is a wonderful thing. But you want to know one of the reasons why we think that? Is because we've never really been wronged. I mean, we've been wronged, but not really, really wronged. And maybe some of you have. And you might be able to understand this reality if perhaps you've had a parent who sexually abused you growing up. Or maybe you've had this, or you know people like this, who have had their family shot in front of their eyes. And you go to someone like that and you say, you know what, you just need to forgive. And you don't need to worry about vengeance. And you know what people like that think? Are you crazy? How could you ever actually stop yourself from taking revenge in situations like that? And the answer is because of what Paul says there in verse 19. God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." So you know what? If God is going to enact justice, I don't have to. That's why I can forgive. That's why I can bless those who persecute me. Because God's going to right every wrong. And he's actually going to do it justly. My problem with vengeance is if someone takes one, what I'm going to do? I'm going to take two. And they're going to want to take three. But God enacts righteous judgment and vengeance. It's he enacts the kind of punishment that's fitting for the crime. And that then frees us from not having to do that. And people know that. That's why they believe that there is justice. And you say, well, if people know all these things, then why are there people who don't believe in God? We'll go back to Romans 1, verse 18. That by their unrighteousness they suppress the truth. And down in verse 21, although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Verse 28. Since they did not see fit to acknowledge God. The problem is not that they don't know God. The problem is they don't want to know Him. Aldous Huxley was a novelist in the early 20th century. He says this: I had motives for not wanting the world to have a meaning. Consequently, I assumed that it had none, and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. Most ignorance is vincible ignorance. We don't know because we don't want to know. And I think I included in your notes Thomas Nagel. I'm talking about something much deeper, namely the fear of religion itself. I speak from experience, being strongly substituted this fear myself. I want atheism to be true, and am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. We won't look there, but in Romans 8, Paul points out, actually the mind apart from Christ is hostile to God. It hates God. And this is a quote from Nietzsche. It's in the words of Zarathustra, but Zarathustra kind of serves as Nietzsche's spokesman in this writing. But God had to die. He saw with eyes that saw everything. He saw man's depths and ultimate grounds, all his concealed disgrace and ugliness. His pity knew no shame. He crawled into my dirtiest nooks. This most curious, over-obtrusive one had to die. He always saw me. On such a witness, I wanted to have my revenge or not live myself. The God who saw everything, even man, this God had to die. Man cannot bear it that such a witness should live. And I think one of the reasons that's true is you look down in verse 32 of Romans 1. That we know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, and yet we do them. We want justice, but we also recognize that justice means we're in trouble. Because we've broken God's laws. And so we don't love God because we've made ourselves His enemies. But the good news is over in Romans 5. So we'll turn over to Romans 5 in verse 6. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows His love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We hate this God. We are His enemies. We are sinners standing in rebellion against God. And yet God died. And so He's able to replace this heart of hatred with a heart of love for Him so that we can know this God who made the world and yet loves us. Because when you really consider atheism, it offers nothing of value. Atheists are always upset about the fact that and trying to find some way of saying, no, you can still have a fulfilling life if you don't believe in God. And that you look at what atheism says and it's like, how could you ever have a fulfilling life? What does that even mean? Because there is no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no morality, we can't know anything, and there is no justice, and yet we all know better.